May it please the court, Michael Francisco, attorney registration number 39111, on behalf of the appellant. This case is about an attempt, for the first time, to expand the jurisdiction of the Independent Ethics Commission to include the policing of the expenditure of public funds, be it an expenditure by the city clerk of Creed, Colorado, population 400, or by the governor himself. The electorate never intended to create such a super controller with authority to police any given expenditure of the more than $22 billion annually expended in Colorado. As this unique proceeding shows, how public funds are spent is simply not within the purview of the IEC. And for good reason. Colorado has long-standing checks and balances over the use of public funds, and the IEC's attempt to review the use of those funds in this case has proven unwieldy and unmanageable, as the IEC even reversed itself a year later and approved the appellant's travel to the very same National Election Law Conference that it's deemed unethical in this case.
Mr. Francisco, let me jump right in, because you've raised many issues in this case. And I want to focus on one question ahead on the jurisdictional piece, and very frankly, I'm not sure I understand your argument. It seems to me, you can read your argument at least in two different ways. One is to say that there's no jurisdiction because the language other standards in Section 5, you know, Article 29, refers to gifts and influence peddling only. So it has to, you know, those other standards have to be some form of gifts or influence peddling. Another reading would be that those other standards, and I'm using shorthand, the other standards don't have to be gifts or influence peddling, but Congress, if they adopt the other, excuse me, General Assembly, if they adopt the other standards, have to refer specifically to Section 5. I've read too much into it on that second piece. Could you help me understand specifically what, does it have to be gifts or influence peddling, or is some other kind of standard okay if it refers back to Section 5, or some different, is it a different thing altogether?
Yes, Your Honor. The argument in the brief, and I'll make some additional clarifications here, is that there has to be a limiting principle to the other standards of conduct language in Section 5, otherwise it's too broad. As we suggested in the brief, one line the court could draw is that it requires an express delegation from the General Assembly. We've suggested a second line in the brief, which is reflected in footnote 6 in the opening brief, that it could be one of the portions of Title 24, Article 18, that is a code of conduct. If you look at Article 18 and Title 24, there are five specific codes of conduct that are subsections within that. As we point out in the brief, the IEC can't have jurisdiction over every part of Article 18 because by their own terms, parts of that section are not enforceable against government employees, but it could be limited to those codes of conduct. Either of those lines lead to the result here, which is the discretionary fund statute in 249105 is outside of their jurisdiction. And that makes sense, which is what I was alluding to earlier, because the IEC exists in its purpose and its adoption by the electorate to police outside money.
So, yes. I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but let me just make sure I understand. So you said two things. There has to be a delegation by the General Assembly, which suggests kind of the second hypothetical I gave you. So you could have gifts, influence peddling, or some other standards of conduct, as long as the General Assembly has done an express delegation, some reference back to the IEC's authority. Am I understanding you correct on that one?
Yes, Your Honor, they're alternative arguments. So
all right.
First of all, nobody's...
I just want to make sure I got it. So it doesn't have to be a gift related just to a gift or influence peddling. It can be broader if there's an express delegation?
Yes, Your Honor, that's okay. That alternative argument. Pointing out is that there's no dispute that the IEC has jurisdiction over gifts and over outside money. The IEC is not contending that the appellant here has violated any of the provisions of the gift ban. And if you look at the express purposes of Article 29 and specific standards governing gifts, it makes sense that they have authority to cover gifts and over that outside money. What we're suggesting with the first line and the second one is that the policing of public funds is completely outside the jurisdiction of the IEC. As an alternative line this court could adopt as to where the jurisdiction ends.
Mr. Francisco, let me pursue that with you. With regard to the constitutional provision we're discussing, As you know, when we're interpreting statutes and constitutional provisions, normally we look to the plain language of them. And so what you're suggesting as two alternative constructions may well be reasonable, but if that was the intent of the people in adopting Article 29 of the Constitution, why wouldn't those specifications or either one of them have been included in Article 29?
The answer to that, Your Honor, is because it was not the focus of Article 29. We think the plain language of other standards of conduct includes looking at the intent of the electorate and the purposes of the provision as a whole. That's the standard interpretive tools the court looks at. And if you look at the blue book, it's consistent with that. There's a lot of detail about the gift ban. $53, exactly which exceptions exist to the gift ban and when it applies. There's absolutely nothing about other standards of conduct.
But the blue book just mentioned that language. It says other standards of conduct and reporting requirements a number of times.
It says it
once. May not explain it, but it says it.
It is included, but it's never defined. And the position of the IEC here is that it simply means apparently anything under the laws or regulations of Colorado. We think that's unconstitutionally vague and far too broad at one level. And secondly, it's inconsistent with the purposes to be accomplished by the adoption of Article 29. So the standard statutory rules of interpretation that the court applies is it was focused on gift bans and outside money. It was not intended to create this mechanism where any legal argument whatsoever could be brought before the IEC and any of the 30,000 plus government employees could be held personally liable for some sort of technical violation.
So, Mr. Francisco, let me come back to my question in light of Judge Gabriel's follow-up question. So are you saying that the plain language analysis doesn't apply here and therefore we have to look to the intent of the electorate in adopting Article 29?
We think they both apply. That's how the court typically runs through. They look at the intent of the electorate and the plain language together when they're interpreting constitutional provisions.
Well, isn't that just if it's ambiguous? Don't you stick with the plain language unless there's some ambiguity which causes you to look further into legislative intent or other things?
Unless it's absurd. There are two responses to that. It cannot be an absurd interpretation, which we believe it is if it covers too broadly. Secondly, constitutional avoidance requires you to adopt a limiting principle if it would raise constitutional concerns. That's the argument in the brief. And third, the idea of ambiguity is clearly encompassed with the vagueness problem. Other standards of conduct, you can consider that to be ambiguous because nobody knows what it refers to.
Okay, you're sort of alleging to overbreadth, and I'm wondering, are you making a facial or as-applied argument on the overbreadth?
There's not an overbreadth concern proper here, and it is a facial argument. What we're talking about specifically are the general principles of interpretation that will allow this court to understand why the discretionary fund statute is beyond the jurisdiction. So if you look at the more limited issue of the discretionary fund statute, there are multiple reasons why that particular statute is beyond their jurisdiction.
Right. I kind of agree with you on the discretionary fund statute by itself, because to the extent that they're interpreting the phrase in pursuance of official business, I'm not sure that the interpretation of that phrase relates to a standard of conduct. But if you look at the public trust statute in combination with the discretionary fund statute, it seems that the public trust statute does describe a standard of conduct which might implicate the use of discretionary funds.
Your Honor, we don't believe the public trust statute is a standard of conduct as a matter of law. You're reading it backwards in that sense to say that this is a violation of the public trust. What the IEC has argued in the case, and they've not changed this position in the briefs, is that the appellant violated the discretionary bond statute. That's the legal violation. Therefore, because of that violation, it was a violation of the public trust. That's the same way that the Article 29 is structured. If you look at the specific gift ban provisions, if you violate a gift ban provision, it then becomes declared because of that specific violation, it violates the public trust. That's in the purposes of Section 1. There's no independent violation of the public trust that they have found or that would be legally sustainable.
I guess, Mr. Francisco, I'd like you to walk me through what the issues here in terms of jurisdiction. So Section 5 of Article 29 says, among other, and other any other standards of conduct and reporting requirements as provided by law. You then look to the discretionary fund statute, and it says these various officials have these public funds, that they can expend in pursuance of official business as each elected official sees fit. Why isn't in pursuance of official business a standard of conduct? Can an elected official have a birthday party for his or her child and say, "That, well, I think that was official business. It, you know, made me look good in the public media." End of story. No oversight whatsoever. Why? I guess the question of is why isn't it, you, that it has to be an expenditure in pursuit of official business? Why is that not a standard of conduct?
Your Honor, of multiple parts of the response there, but it's important to differentiate the two arguments here. First, there's no jurisdiction over the discretionary fund statute, even if there were some violation, and it's an, and we do contend that it was wrong as a matter of law to find there was a violation here. That's very clearly highlighted by the subsequent advisory opinions, which find it to be official business for the Deputy Secretary of State and the Secretary to go to the very same conference.
And the problem is those are not in the record.
They're subject to judicial notice, Your Honor. They're like court opinions. They are publicly available. They're reliable. They have to be considered as evidence of how it was arbitrary. But your question also gets to an important point, which is there are checks and balances in the system to police whether or not the discretionary funds are being used properly. And so the IEC doesn't have to police those. First of all, there's longstanding checks over all expenditures of public funds, not just the $5,000 here, but the whole $22 billion. That's a complex system that includes appropriations, the audit committee, the controller, there's a whistleblower statute where employees can complain about it. That always applies. Secondly, there are checks because this is an elected official specific statute. It's unique in that regard. There are political checks on how the money is used that can be disclosed publicly on how it is used. And lastly, there are criminal embezzlement statutes that would apply to any government official if they misuse public funds to that extent. So there are plenty of checks in the system that exists. And with that, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Francisco. You have 3 minutes and 10 seconds remaining.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Joel Kesey, number 38078, and I represent the appellees in this case, the Independent Ethics Commission, and its commissioners in their official capacities. In November of 2006, the voters of Colorado approved Article 29 of the Colorado Constitution, creating a single independent ethics commission tasked with overseeing the ethics issues related to public officers and government employees. The clear intent was to protect the public's trust and confidence in the government of this great state by creating a central venue for the public to bring ethics issue complaints under not just the gift ban, but Article 29 and under any other standards of conduct that are provided by law. In this case, the Ethics Commission acted within the scope of this authority and it followed its constitutionally mandated duty, finding that the Secretary's 2012 trip to Florida and his clearing out of the discretionary fund account at the end of the fiscal year 2011-2012 were violations of ethical standards of conduct that the public funds contained in the discretionary fund account be spent in pursuance of official business and that the Secretary act for the benefit of the people of the state. The three issues raised by the Secretary in this case are straightforward. First, Article 29's plain and unambiguous language provides the Ethics Commission with jurisdiction. Second, the Ethics Commission's decision is supported by substantial evidence in the record and is not contrary to law. Third, the Secretary was provided with notice of both the legal charges and the facts in this case prior to the June 7, 2013 hearing. Unless this court has questions on the notice issue, I will focus my short time here today on the jurisdiction and Ethics Commission decision issues. Turning to the first issue, the plain language of Article 29 grants the Ethics Commission jurisdiction in this case. As Judge Gabriel pointed out, Section 5 of Article 29 provides that the Ethics Commission's purpose is to hear complaints, issue findings, and assess penalties on ethics issues arising under this article, Article 29, and any other standards of conduct and reporting requirements as provided by law.
Mr. Francisco said that there needs to be a limiting principle to that last phrase that you just cited. in your view, what is that limiting principle? Or is it not necessary to have one?
Well, I think that there is a limiting principle, but I don't think it's for this court to make a decision about what the extremities, the external limits are. I think the court should look to what occurred in this case, which is the application of that standard to the discretionary fund statute and the public trust statute.
Let's look at the discretionary fund statute. So
sure.
What they were basically doing was deciding whether the expenditure was or was not in pursuance of official business.
That's correct.
And I guess I'm confused as to how that qualifies as a standard of conduct or reporting requirement, because it seems it's just a purpose for expenditure. Like, if it were more specific, it would say they have to be used for purchasing books for the office. I mean, if that wasn't purchasing books, I'm still not sure how that's a standard of conduct.
Well, I think that if you look, and I think this gets to Mr. Francisco's argument as well, if you look at the purpose of Article 29, which is in Section 1 of Article 29, there are a couple of issues there. One is the protection of the public's trust and confidence in the government, and another one is this justifiable, or to avoid a justifiable impression that that the public officers aren't acting for the benefit of the people of the state. And so to get to your question, the issue of the in pursuance of official business is an ethical standard of conduct that's required, because this is expenditure of funds by a public officer. This is, it's our position that this is exactly the sort of thing that the voters intended when they enacted Article 29, granting the Ethics Commission the opportunity to review the activities of these public officers who would otherwise potentially spend the funds in the discretionary fund account however they would want. And I think this goes to Judge Gabriel's point of, are there any limitations to what the secretary could have spent these discretionary funds on? And the answer is yes. The limitation is that it must be in pursuance of official business, and that's for the Ethics Commission to decide if it's constitutionally mandated.
What makes something qualify as a standard of conduct?
Well, I don't know that I would be able to answer that question, because that's a question that the Ethics Commission itself would have to make a determination. But in this case, the Ethics Commission decided that the discretionary fund statute and the public trust statutes were standards of conduct. And I think that those are things that the Ethics Commission
You're saying anytime the Ethics Commission wants to interpret a statutory phrase that relates to some duty of a public official, that they can just branded a standard of conduct?
No, I would not agree with that. The standard set forth in Section 5 of Article 29 provides that the standard is limited. It's limited to ethical issues. It's limited to standards of conduct. It's limited to those ethical standards that are provided by law. And it's limited to the conduct of public officers and government employees. It's in fact also limited by the standards of judicial review and appellate review, which we have going on here today.
Mr. Kesey, let me ask just a clarification on this phrase, other standards of conduct and reporting requirements as provided by law.
That's right.
Does as provided by law apply to both standards of conduct and reporting requirements? So it has to be a standard of conduct provided by law or no?
I would say that as provided by law, it would have whatever the standard or reporting requirement that they would potentially look to, it would have to be as provided by law.
All right, so the Independent Ethics Commission just can't decide X is a standard of conduct. It has to be somewhere it's placed in the law, and your argument is the discretionary fund statute is where they put it's in the law.
Exactly.
Mr. Kesey, let me ask you about the discretionary fund statute in light of the Colorado Supreme Court's approval of CLE credit for the conference that Mr. Gessler attended. How do those two square with one another?
Well, Your Honor, in this circumstance, and that's really more a challenge of the Ethics Commission's decision itself. Here, the Ethics Commission sat as the trier of fact. They were there for an 11-hour hearing. There was multiple witnesses that testified, including the secretary. And so they are entitled to the deference of making a determination of fact. And so while the fact that it was the CLE was approved as credit by the Colorado Supreme Court, that's one fact that was in evidence in this case. However, there are other facts that show that that there were violations of the discretionary fund statute by the expenditures not being in pursuance of official business. And I'd be happy to turn to those and discuss those facts and evidence to support that. First of all, the Ethics Commission found specifically and made findings that the $1,278.90 that the secretary was reimbursed for his travel to the Republican National Lawyers Association convention was, quote, for primarily partisan purposes and therefore personal purposes to fly to Florida to attend the RLNA conference and thereafter attend the RNC. This is a finding of fact. The second area was that the secretary received $117.99 from the discretionary fund account as, quote, the balance of the discretionary account without any documentation or detail of expenses incurred. And that is also a finding of fact. So the standard must be that there's no substantial evidence in the record supporting these findings. And as Judge Talman, you raised, the issue is that there was some evidence that there was a CLE, that was approved for CLE credit. However, there are many other facts that support the Ethics Commission's specific findings. First, we'll talk about the 2012 trip to Florida. The facts were clear that the secretary traveled to Tampa, Florida for both the Republican National Lawyers Convention and the Republican National Convention. In addition, the $1,278.90 included fees for the secretary to be reimbursed for his hotel stay. That hotel stay included a discounted rate during the time of the RLNA conference, which was on the Friday and Saturday before the start of the RNC on Monday. But it also included a second day at the full price of $269 for staying at the Ritz-Carlton in Sarasota, Florida, after the RLNA conference had ended. In addition, there are facts that established that the participants who were attending the RLNA conference had to agree to the RLNA mission statement, which included advancing Republican ideals and party goals. There were topics at the RNLAC, which were not on Colorado law, and there was a partisan event with the Romney legal team during the time of the RNC, the RNLAC. And finally, and I think very importantly, was the testimony of the secretary. As I mentioned before, the Ethics Commission was there to assess the credibility and hear the witness testimony. And in this case, the secretary testified that he could not recall details or specifics of the RNALC, including what was presented or what he discussed as a scheduled speaker.
Mr. Casey, let me follow up and ask you about that, because your description of what happened and Mr. Francisco's description of what happened are like the difference between night and day. He yes, said sir. In his reply brief that while Mr. Gessler initially didn't recall what happened, in the subsequent question he did recall and testified fairly specifically about the seminar in which he participated and about other sessions which he attended.
Sure.
Do you agree with that assessment?
I do not. And I think there are two parts to this. The first part, however, is that we must keep in mind that the Ethics Commission is a trier of fact, and so they're able to they're able to assess the testimony in the way that they think is most appropriate. And if you look to the Ethics Commission's decision, they specifically highlight that the secretary was unable to remember what he presented on and what he attended at the hearing. But what I would direct the court's attention to specific pages of the record. They contain the transcript from the hearing and the secretary's testimony. As a sort of overview of it, what initially had happened was that the attorney for Ethics Watch, who's the complainant in the case, had asked on direct testimony the secretary about his memory of what had occurred. The secretary thought that he had presented on a topic that didn't have his name on it. I think it was session 3 at the RNLAC. Then looked at session 2, and I'll read from just the record very briefly. The question that was pending was, I will ask you if you can recall what your portion of the presentation was about. And the secretary's answer was, I can't be absolutely certain, but I think I talked a lot about military overseas, because we've been doing a lot in Colorado on those lines, and I probably addressed the other two issues as well, the absentee and early voting issues. The secretary was then, his attention was brought to the fact that he was looking at the wrong session, and the answer was, I'm looking at the wrong one. It shows you that I don't quite entirely remember. Mr. Toro, who's asking the question, says, I apologize, it's under session 2. The answer from the secretary was, I don't remember. Obviously, I thought I talked about session number 3, so I don't know. I don't remember. Later on, the question was asked of the secretary, can you think of any other subjects that were presented at this seminar besides the section 5 photo ID issue? Answer, well, I don't remember them specifically, but I will assume, and this is just surmising, And then the secretary goes on to talk about some of the discussion about what he thought maybe was related to the federal ID issue. But I think it was clear that the secretary wasn't entirely certain about what he had talked about. And one area that the secretary did remember was a discussion on the war room. Apparently there was a session about the war room that he did talk extensively about and said that he remembered and was helpful. He also testified later on cross-examination that he mentioned there was some campaign finance issue that occurred. But his first answers were that he did not remember. Turning to the second issue for which the Ethics Commission had facts in the record supporting its determination was that the secretary had cleared out the discretionary fund account at the end of fiscal year 2011 and 2012. Looking at the secretary's specific request, and this is on page 993 of the record, the administrative record, it's exhibit one at trial, the secretary only requested, quote, any remaining discretionary funds. He did not request any reimbursements whatsoever. He didn't request mileage reimbursements. He didn't ask anything.
Mr. Casey, just a quick factual question. You said twice that this was at the end of the fiscal year. My recollection from the briefs is that it was in July of 2012, and I thought that the fiscal year ended at the end of June.
That's correct, Your Honor. But his request was dated July 5th of 2012, but the final day of the fiscal year was the last day of June 2012.
Okay.
Factually, that's what the record supports. Yes. He provided no receipts or documentation at the time of his request, and the Ethics Commission, again, was sitting as the finder of fact, had the opportunity to see the other evidence that was presented, that the other requests contain receipts or documentation. In addition, the Secretary of State had received notice from the State Controller's Office that the discretionary funds account should be used only for official business, not for personal use, and that all expenditures should have supporting documentation. Those are in the record at pages 999 through 1000 and 1108 through 12. And finally, the Secretary specifically testified at the hearing that he did not include unreimbursed mileage charges in his request because, quote, to go through every single penny and mile and whatnot, it just ended up being a waste of time when there is no benefit from it. And that's on page 636 of the district court record. One of the themes of the secretary's testimony was this idea that the discretionary fund account was to be used either from a personal income perspective or not. So if he provided documentation, it wasn't personal income. If he didn't provide the documentation, then it was not personal income. And there, I think it's clear from reading the testimony that the secretary didn't really have a regard for whether or not there would be official business that these funds would be used for. It was really a question of whether or not he'd be taxed for it. And as I see my time is getting short here, in conclusion, as the Ethics Commission had jurisdiction, its decision is supported by substantial evidence in the record, and the Secretary received adequate notice, we ask that you affirm the District Court's order. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Casey.
Thank you. I'd like to make, if I could, three brief points. First, a bit of a technical observation about going to Judge Boris's questions about standards of conduct. I came across a helpful case preparing for argument that's not in the briefs. It's LDS versus Healy, Colorado Supreme Court case from 1959, 589 P. 2nd, 490, specifically discusses codes of conduct and that cannot be impermissibly vague. It's in a real estate licensing context, provides some helpful guidance. But secondly, as we do make in the briefs, the codes of conduct is something that Article 29 speaks to when it says you have to provide specific guidance to government employees. That's one of the purposes in Section 1 of 29. And we think that the IEC's position is just too broad. It's as startling and sweeping as it is simple, and that is any law, any violation is within their jurisdiction. No court has held that. It would be a novel holding for that to be upheld here.
I know what you're going to get through your three points, and I will let you. Your statement just strikes me as too broad, Mr. Francisco. They're not saying they have jurisdiction over any law anywhere. It has to be a standard of conduct or a reporting requirement as required by law. So it's not just aiding, and that's what I think I asked you in your opening argument here, too. Am I wrong about that? I'm just concerned that you've painted the picture, and you're being a very good advocate, and I understand why you're doing it, but I'm concerned what you just said is too broad. I don't think the IEC is arguing it has jurisdiction over everything anywhere.
Well, Your Honor, if I may, we provide a very list of parade of horribles, if you will, in the brief, including criminal statutes, the personnel board rules, and a lot of regulations. They did not counter and say that they do not have jurisdiction over anything in that long list in the opening brief of 18 different laws. Secondly, if you look at their brief where they try to provide a limit on page 15, their limit is it has to be in the law, and they have to find it to be a standard, but they've interpreted, I see no way to interpret their position as anything else than if you violate a law, the law sets a standard, and that's an ethical issue to have violated the law. And it is so broad to include a discretionary appropriation statute in this case. If we're looking at the $22 billion of appropriations in Colorado, this has to be, as far as I know, the smallest granular appropriation statute of $5,000 in the entire code, and it's given to the discretion in its title and operative language to one official. So if they can reach this part of the public expenditures, then I don't see any way that they cannot reach any other public expenditure, which really does get to my one of the points I wanted to make. Public expenditures are often politically controversial, not just the ones in this case. When the Attorney General decides to use discretionary funds and resources to file amicus briefs, whether that's a brief in favor of traditional marriage or in favor of same-sex marriage, or whether it's a gun control brief, political groups often disagree with the discretionary use of state resources. But that doesn't transform it into an ethics issue, and their position has no limit in that regard. The other point I wanted to raise to your attention is the idea of deference. It's black letter law that you've got to defer to a litigating position of an agency. If you read the FCC versus Arlington case cited in the briefs, it talks about United States versus Meade. It's a well-known principle of agency law that you don't defer when it's a litigating position. And I want to make clear that that's what it is here, is a litigating position. There's been no rulemaking. There's nothing from the IEC that says other standards of conduct includes everything in Title 24, Section 9. They don't have that. They have claim jurisdiction over everything in this case that has been brought before them, and it's too broad, yes.
Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Francisco. Thank you, Mr. Kesey.
Judge, may I say something before you? I know you'll do your concluding. I just want to thank counsel for the professionalism here, and I try to do this. It's important for all of us. I recognize this is always an odd circumstance when you've got colleagues on both sides. It takes incredible professionalism and civility, and I think it's going to be for all of us. We're all very impressed with what we saw here today and throughout, so I wanted to thank everybody involved.
So, thank you, Judge Gabriel. I would echo Judge Gabriel's views. Mr. Kesey, I was going to ask you if you would like an opportunity to respond in writing to Mr. Francisco's citation of the LDS v. Healy case.
Your Honor, I think we would like that opportunity if you would allow.
Yes, we would. I would ask that you submit something in writing. Would next Monday be sufficient? And of no more than 3 pages, and you can just file it with the court, and then we'll be able to consider that as well. Thank you both for your excellent arguments this morning. We appreciate them. I'm sure they'll help us in resolving the difficult issues presented in this case. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.